The Money Show with Motheo Kgwaripe on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP. Hello and thank you for joining us on this Thursday evening's Money Show. My name is Motheo Kgwaripe. It's been a busy-ish day on the market with a lot of activity at One Exchange Square at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. This as used car reseller We Buy Cars blew the kudu horn today, listing on the JSE at 20 Rand per share, above the initial public offering price at 18 Rand 75 a share. This now values We Buy Cars at around 8.5 billion Rand. We'll be speaking to the founder and executive director of We Buy Cars, Fun Funder Vault, here on The Money Show, finding out whether the nerves have settled after this particular listing and where the company is headed. Then come midnight, e-tolls will be a thing of the past, or maybe not entirely. And how will this affect commercial vehicle operators in the country? We find out with Wayne Duvenage, CEO at the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Later on the show, the keen relationship between chief marketing officers and chief financial officers. The other end wants to spend money to promote the company and its brands, while the other end wants to keep finances at a low and keep the bottom line quite healthy. So how does this dynamic partnership come together these days? Kensani Nobanda, Nedbank's group executive of marketing and corporate affairs, will join us on The Money Show later on. In our small business focus, we look at business coaching and how it differs from mentorship and consulting. That with Anton Ressel, strategic head for SME support at Fedola. In our investment school feature today, why we fall for dodgy investments and how to avoid them. We'll be getting all those gems from our head teacher, Viv Govender, a portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, tonight on The Money Show.
The Money Show will give you all the tools you need to navigate the complicated world of economics and commerce. Even if you're not a numbers person. The Money Show.
With Motheo Kgwaripe.
6 to 8 p.m. Making money makes sense.
On 702 and Cape Talk.
But firstly, we start here with not so good news. Mining sector has been bleeding a lot of jobs, and it seems more and more will be lost on in the mining sector, given that Sibanye Gold announcing that it will shed close to around more than 4,000 jobs. Rather, Peter Major, mining expert and director of mining at Modern Corporate Solutions, joining us for this particular conversation. Peter, just last week, you and I had a conversation about a landmark wage deal in the mining sector, saving a lot of jobs, but also bringing stability a week later, showing just the volatility of the sector, some jobs could be lost.
Unfortunately, it looks that way. And there's not many people much sadder than I am, especially when it's our gold sector, which is what made South Africa so famous. And we still have close to half the world's known gold. But what we have to realize, even though we've got very mature unions, we've got very experienced management, and we don't seem to have hardly any of the labor difficulties we knew before, it's been a hard, long road. And there's been very little capital put into these gold mines in literally two decades. And we hear the term harvest. That's what's happened, is the mining companies, especially the gold companies, have been harvesting what they've got, which means they're pretty much gutting out whatever's available and possible, but they're not sinking new shafts. They're not building new levels. That takes a long-term vision. That takes long-term confidence. You sink a shaft, it's 8 to 10 years. It's billions. And there's not the confidence in the country anymore. There's not policy that's conducive to that. So the fact that we have a record gold price, record gold price, and we're still getting these layoffs, it just shows how old and fragile these mining companies are.
I was about to say, Peter, that somebody that's looking at the JSE and, you know, looking at the spot price of gold would have said, hey, hang on, I'm sure there could be something done here to save these jobs. But of course, metal prices have also suffered last year, which is a big knock for Sibanye Stillwater.
You know, mining is a long-term, highly capital-intensive business. And there's very little return for the first 5 to 10 years. So you need huge confidence to sink these shafts and build these enormous mines, to spend billions and billions of years. You need a huge confidence. And unfortunately, our government has done the opposite. They've chased away foreign investment. You can't build a mine without foreign investment. And you need confidence to spend money on CAPEX. And it's just not happening. And there's still a lot of gold in our ground. You know, we should have had another 100 years. And these aren't mines closing down, but it's divisions of old mines. So the fact that 4,000 men are being laid off from Kloof and Beatrix, I don't know what that is percentage-wise, but I don't think it's 15% of the total workforce. So it's unprofitable divisions that have to be closed, and you try and transfer them in where you can. Because to run an unprofitable part of the mine means you're throwing away money that could be used in a better area of the mine. And everybody wants to extend the life of the mine as much as they can under this gold price. So rather than lose money on one part of the mine, you close that and you're making profits on the other parts that you can reinvest and at least get another 5 years or another 10 years, hopefully. You're juggling a lot here, but it's sad to see this under the great gold price we have.
As government looking at the mining sector and the volatility that we've seen, at least over the past year in terms of prices, but also these job losses that these companies are forced to get into, what policies are you putting in place to make sure that going forward into the future of mining, some of these jobs can be sustained?
That is an excellent question that we should all be asking government. You know, government are the caretakers of our resources. They should be designing and implementing policies that exploit our resources, that don't chase away foreign investment, that don't force mines to stop spending CAPEX. And I know I've been critical of the unions for a long time that were asking unrealistic wage increases, literally for two decades in a row. And they had violent strikes that cost the companies money. And that's all come to being now. You know, all those negative actions for 20 years have resulted and just a handful of very old mines. We don't have new gold mines. So all those resources we have in the ground are just going to lay there forever now. They will never be exploited. But government could still do a turnaround in policy. They could go to the mining company and say, tell us how we can alter our policy to make you invest more, to make you take some of the money that you're spending offshore and put it into mines here. At least have roundtable discussions, because we're endowed with these huge gold resources,
yeah,
but you've got to make it attractive for people to spend money to get them out.
Thank you very much, Peter Major, the mining expert and director of mining at Morden Corporate Solutions. Do apologize for that sound, but got the crux of it. Sibanye-Stillwater announcing another round of retrenchment talks for its South African gold operations, which could affect more than 4,000 employees and contractors.
The Money Show with Motheo Kgwaripe
on 702.
702.
Well, later today at midnight, e-tolls are due to go off. The civic body, the organization Undoing Tax Abuse, says government has sent confusing messages about the e-tolls switch off. They're going to go off, but you still need to pay. All these things could be affecting all sorts of operations, including commercial operators like trucks and car hire services. Wayne Duvenage, CEO at the organization Undoing Tax Abuse. Wayne, the mixed signals we're getting from yesterday, especially from Transport Minister Sindisiwe Chikunga, who published the Government Gazette of notice concerning the withdrawal of the e-toll declaration of the Gauteng Freeway Improvement Project, popularly known as e-tolls. Are they going off, and what does this mean for business?
Yes, they are being switched off at midnight. It's been a long journey. They declared these roads as toll roads in 2008, and we were none the wiser then. It was very quietly done. And the furor has been relentless ever since we learnt about this in late 2010. And the rest is history. We've managed as the public in a civil disobedience campaign, a very civil one and a constructive one, to get government to realize they made a bad decision and they are now being forced. They've been forced literally to switch the scheme off, and to do so they had to gazette it. And finally, after 10 years of this scheme being operating, it is now dead. But what this means for business is going forward, as they travel on these freeways, they are now freeways. You don't have to pay to use them, as you didn't pay in the past. As many cities around the country, commuters on traveling on those freeways do not have to pay, because those are non-tolled roads, and this is how these roads should have been all along. So I think we need to celebrate this going forward. Those who have outstanding bills do not need to worry. That is not debt, as SANRAL and governments claim or think that the public must pay for that. They don't have to pay for it, and I think the government needs to realize that the calls for the public to pay is a futile one.
From your understanding, from what you saw at the presser yesterday, does government actually understand what went wrong here with this particular e-toll system?
No, they don't. You know, I think if they did, they would have sent a very clear message to say, you know, this is a classic example of the people have spoken. We made a mistake. We didn't do a number of things properly, including the research. We forged ahead arrogantly, and we never listened. And from this, we will learn what public engagement, meaningful public engagement, means. And we want to thank the motorists for teaching us a lesson, for standing up to bad policy. They've never mentioned any of that. All they're doing now is claiming that it is their decision, and on behalf of the people, and government has now made this decision a favorable one, and we're on the side of history. They're not on the side of history from the perspective that they need to acknowledge they got it wrong completely. They haven't done that. They haven't even acknowledged the fact that they overpaid for the roads. We say by at least 14 billion rand more than what they should have borrowed for this upgrade. And so that's three times the price, by the way, that you and I end up having to pay. And on top of that, they granted ETC the five-year contract to collect these tolls at a price tag, if they told us, of 6.2 billion rand, when in actual fact, they signed the contract at 9.8 billion rand. That is corruption in our eyes. The government is not saying anything about that. And until they do, they are part of the problem, and they have no right to claim any good work on their behalf. This good work comes from the people who defied the scheme and stood their ground.
Businesses would have wanted to be law-abiding citizens. Those with Class B medium vehicles, Class C heavy vehicles would have wanted to register with this to make sure that they're compliant, would have paid a lot of money over the period to make sure that they do have e-tolls and they are compliant with the Gauteng rules. Do they have any recourse here? How do they get their money back?
No, they won't get their money back. And most of those businesses pass those costs on, especially car rental companies, logistics companies. They pass those costs on to their customers. It's not possible to get the money back because SANRAL haven't been collecting it unlawfully. There's no judgment that's come up that said it was unlawful. Otherwise, they would have had to go and pay it back then. And plus, they can't afford it right now. So I don't think anybody who has paid is going to get their funds back. I think what those businesses should now start be acknowledging and thanking ARTA and other organizations and the public for standing their ground, because they don't have to pay going forward. Now, I say that in a way that, you know, we don't expect infrastructure to be free. We have to pay for it some way. But there were alternative methods to pay for these roads that government ignored, that we put to them long ago. And had they done that, this would have been a far less costly affair than it has turned out. So government has wasted a lot of money, a lot of your money and my money, as a result of this bad decision. And they took 5 years to implement it when they realized in 2019 that they'd made a mistake and they stopped summonsing the public. Why it took us so long for them to implement this simple decision, we cannot understand. But it is just all comes down to bad governance, bad leadership.
We're still left with the gantries. We're still left with the infrastructure. You're convinced with the plans to alternatively use them?
Yeah, look, I mean, it makes sense. Again, SANRAL is the custodian of our money. And if we can repurpose those gantries and start to claw back some of the funds to settle those that debt, then yes. So it's good that the tag system still remains in place. It is an interoperable one. You can use it on other toll routes. You can use it now to enter into parking garages where they do contracts there so that you don't have to stand in the ticket systems and pay there. So there's going to be a lot of benefit from the scheme, but that doesn't necessarily offset the massive waste of money and the amount of gantries that they put up and the money they've paid to manage this whole scheme for the last 10 years.
Well, e-tolls will go off later at midnight today. Businesses paid a hefty e-toll fees during the time, but we'll have to let bygones be bygones. Thank you to Wayne Duvenage, the CEO at the organization Undoing Tax Abuse.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
There was some great activity at number 2 Gwen Lane at the Johannesburg Stock Exchange today. We Buy Cars listing on the JSE. Of course, local market starving for a lot of those listings. But the local market at end of day, not looking so good. The all share down 217 points. Industrials were in weaker territory. Banking and financial stocks, second day running, still in negative territory, while mining shares were also down today. Joining us for the markets today is Rudy van der Merwe, portfolio manager at Advice Works. Rudy, the local market not performing as well, but let's start with the exciting story of a listing on the JSE.
Evening, Mateo. Yeah, very positive news. You know, we've had a lot of companies disappearing from the JSE. It's nice to see one come back, and it looks like certainly for the moment it's been quite positively received. The share price closed around 2050 odd, which is up about 1.5% from where it started. So that would translate into a market valuation of about 8.5 roughly billion rand for WeBuy Cars. And you know, it's a company that I think will be sort of here to stay, and in the long term the prospects look reasonably decent.
Do you think the market will assess this business where you can buy a car online and get it delivered as something for the future, especially since it's been separated from its debt-laden transaction capital?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's obviously has been unbundled from transaction capital. Unfortunately, they got themselves in difficulty. And when that happens, you know, you need to sell off, unfortunately, the crown jewels rather than the parts of the business that got you in trouble very often. And that's sort of what's happened with WeBuy Cars. It is largely the crown jewels of transaction capital. So they sold off a portion of that business, and so they've managed to raise capital to the tune of probably 1.25-ish billion rand. And then the rest got unbundled to shareholders of transaction capital, who are now owners of WeBuy Cars. I think the business is a very valid one, a very valid business model. It's very technology driven. It makes it extremely easy for people to do business with them, to get paid for a vehicle or to pay for a vehicle to get it delivered and transferred into your name. They make it really easy, and I think there's a lot of legs to the business, and I think that, you know, competitively they're very well positioned. Unfortunately, the general outlook for vehicle sales is probably not marvelous at the moment. We're in a difficult economic situation. Interest rates are high, consumers are under pressure. So the environment isn't very easy, but I suspect that over time they have the potential to continue taking market share from that sector, and that they will be a survivor and produce positive earnings growth over time.
But we take the good with the bad on the JSE today. Sibanye Stillwater down more than 3%. Of course, another leg of job losses in terms of this particular company, especially in its gold operations, more than 4,000 to be shed. How do you see, these job losses being, nipped in the bud, given that the prices are not playing ball?
I think there are two elements to it. One part is obviously prices, and specifically, actually, gold's looking fine at the moment. But the company was also very exposed to platinum, palladium, and those prices have been under a lot of pressure over the last year. Palladium's down 25-odd% from where it was a year ago, and platinum's down over 3% from where it was a year ago. And those are the sort of major portions of Sibanye's cash flow. So actually, Sibanye is in a position where it's got generating at current prices negative cash flow. So they're not currently operationally making money. So they're in a very difficult spot. So part of this has to do with those commodity prices, which are largely beyond their control. The other is obviously the mining legislation and certainty around mining, which over time has impacted businesses of enthusiasm to invest, and that means that additional production that they could have brought online years ago is just not contributing to current cash flows, unfortunately. So it is very unfortunate. It's unfortunate for the country. It means there's less tax revenue, and obviously there's potentially some families that are going to be placed under pressure as a result of this, which is very unfortunate.
It's a day after that higher than expected US inflation number. Do you think this plays into the thinking of the South African Reserve Bank then maybe to hold rates for longer this year?
Pretty much undoubtedly, yes. It will have an influence. So inflation data that came out of America yesterday was worse than expected, and it's now about the third or fourth consecutive set of data that's been disappointing. Certainly, there's lots of indications that inflation's accelerating rather than slowing in the US at the moment. There was further PPI data today, and the month-on-month numbers look better, but actually year-on-year, the data is worse. The inflation, the PPI numbers have gone from 1.6% to 2.1% year-on-year numbers, and even the core numbers have moved from 2.1% to 2.4%. So it's not a great set of data, and also indicates that there's still inflationary pressure in the US. It is difficult for emerging markets to start cutting rates ahead of the US. We don't want to get our currency unnecessarily to weaken, which could be one of the consequences of doing that, which would then engender even more inflation from an imported pricing perspective. So yeah, I think we probably will be on hold at least till the US starts cutting rates before we can do anything. And for the moment, it certainly seems like there's still inflationary pressures around. There's a massive amount of deficit spending by governments around the world, and I think that's partly to blame for this. I think we're going to be hard-pressed to see anywhere near the interest rate cuts that the globe is expecting at the moment, unfortunately.
All right. Thank you, Rudy van der Merwe, Portfolio Manager at AdviceWorks, covering the markets there with us. The Rand at 18.76 against the dollar, holding on to very, very marginal gains against the greenback at 20.10 against the euro, and at 23.51 against the British pound.
You're with Motheo Faribe on 702 and Cape Talk.
20 minutes to 7. Welcome back to The Money Show. It's been a while since the kudu horn has been blown at the JSE. But today, the sound rang out at One Exchange Square at the local Bost. We Buy Cars, the second-hand car reseller, finally listing on the local Bost. Shares of the used car firm opening at 20 Rand per share, above the initial public offering price of 18 Rand 75 a share. We Buy Cars, established in 2001, providing a quick, easy and trusted solution to selling pre-owned vehicles, including the option of buying online and having your car delivered. Of course, the car company unbundled from Transaction Capital, that's handling quite hefty debt, and is going on its own here on the JSE. We're joined by Van van der Walt, the founder and executive director at We Buy Cars. Van, looking back 23 years ago, did you have plans to list 20 years after operation, or they were earlier and now is the right time?
Good evening, Mateo, and to the listeners. Yeah, I must say it feels unreal. We never had the plan or the vision to get listed until very recently. It's been a growth journey where we focused on our own business, not looking too far ahead, and just focusing on little things we can change. And that's why, we never had big plans. But, for us today, we are a big company. We've grown and we've been blessed in leaps and bounds. We now sell in excess of 14,000 cars a month. So I guess the time was right for us to be listed. And we're very, very thankful that we had this opportunity. It's not every entrepreneur who gets the chance and the opportunity to have their company listed on the stock exchange.
But I guess the work starts the day after the listing, right, where you have to consistently prove to shareholders why they should value this particular company. What's the plans going forward in at least the next 5 years?
Yeah, it's a fantastic question. We've always focused on the business. We're not a company that knee-jerk and make changes very easily. We know what we're good at. We stick to our knitting. So the plan moving forward is to exactly continue in that same trend, doing what we do well and improving that. Recently, we were signing share certificates, for new shareholders, and realized and saw who the new shareholders in our business would be. And these include pension funds and municipality pension funds, investors and all the like. So, we now, as a listed company, carry a great responsibility which we take seriously. We'll make sure that we do our very best to sustain the growth that we've been experiencing over the years. Hopefully we can keep that momentum and grow even further in the years to come. Right now, we estimate our market share to sit around 12% of the used market in South Africa. So there's lots of room to grow, and we firmly believe that our best years are yet to come.
Now, you've already raised over 750 million rand in new capital when you had a private placement of this We Buy Car stock. That war chest, what do you plan to do with it as you raise more money for the business?
Well, in fact, the war chest, as you describe it, is not We Buy Cars. It's capital raised by Transaction Capital prior to the unbundling. So the bulk of that cash goes to serving the obligations in terms of debt, etc., and settling other obligations they have. That being said, We Buy Cars is very cash generative and we are very conservatively geared. So any capital that we require for our growth is available, and the capital is not something that will deter us from growing.
Let's talk about that unbundling from Transaction Capital. Couldn't have been easy for them to let go of a crown jewel like We Buy Cars into the public sphere when listing on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. But it seems it could pay out, or pay off rather, given that there is still that debt question, the heavy debt question that still needs to be settled because of the SA Taxi business.
Yeah, that's right. I think, and that's also why the share price took such a big knock, because of the fact that I think shareholders didn't really understand what's going on. And now with the unbundling, We Buy Cars is a business that's very easy to understand. The accounting principles are sound, and investors will appreciate, the fact that when you look at our results, there's nothing hidden. People will be able to understand it. It's a simple business, although there's a lot of complication in what we do, and that's why we are successful, but at least the financials would be easy to understand. So yeah, the value would be there. As far as Transaction Capital is concerned, I'm sure that they will now utilize, or have utilized, these funds in order to service their obligations.
You're now a company that's on the JSE. You have a target on your back. I know you're looking to get into a better market share for yourselves as We Buy Cars, but coming up against giants like Motus, what's the plan in making sure that you dribble the big players?
Yeah, well, we've never really considered Motus as a competitor or a direct competitor to us. Same with the other big players, because when you look at We Buy Cars, we are solely focused on the used space, where these other players make a large component of their business would be parts, new vehicle sales, and the used would only play a fraction of the role of what they do. And then that used segment would only focus on 1 to 3 year old vehicles. So they, we do quite a lot of business with them. They purchase vehicles from us. So it's a good synergy. We don't see these oaks as competitors. We'll certainly be in a position to grow market share in the years to come, because we serve the whole car park and not only a segment of it.
These oaks that you talk about, the bigger players, Fana, you're not, concerned that, given that it's a tight market, cost of living crisis, a lot of more consumers are looking for second-hand cars, that they'll want to play in your space?
I guess everyone's welcome to. We've seen many competitors come and go over the years. There's quite a few around. And what that's done is just create awareness of the service that's available. I recall many years ago when we were still having billboards and advertisements in newspapers, we saw one day competitors advertising right next to us, and I thought to myself, oh goodness, now we have to share the market with these guys. But in essence, it just creates more awareness of the service. It's then top of mind, and more people trade. And We recently had another competitor open shop not far from us. In the months after that, you know, we had record months at that facility. So it just goes to show, you know, competition is good. It stimulates the market and it keeps everyone on their toes.
Auto Trader, Wheelie, of course, watching today's listings, probably thinking we're going to come for your business. But good luck to you, Fun Fun Laval, the founder and executive director at We Buy Cars, this year's second listing on the JSE. Very good news for the local boss, which has suffered quite a bit of a drought when it comes to those listings. Welcome back to The Money Show. Looking at Sunkin now, creating a sun protection clothing. I want to get into that right now with Dia Kutsia, the founder of Sunkin, talking about this latest innovation, of course, backed by the Cancer Association of South Africa. Dia, welcome to The Money Show. Dia, I don't know if you can hear me. Dia?
Hello.
There we go. Talking about the skin's barrier through this particular product that you've come up with that provides sun protection. Tell us more about the clothing.
So the product is, the brand is called Sunkin and it's Sun Safe Apparel. And it is UV protective clothing for children for every day. So we tend to think of children needing sun protective clothing just on the beach or by the pool, but actually our clothes don't really provide adequate protection, and that's our focus.
Then looking at this, how is it different then from wearing sunscreen as a lotion? Have you built some form of technology that acts the same as what sunscreen would?
So sunscreen is fine on the parts of the body that are exposed, but as I saw a lot of parents do, we apply sunscreen to our children's, you know, arms, face and legs, and we forget about the torso, you know, and other places like that the clothing covers. But actually what we, you know, what I learned and was shocked about and was the catalyst for this is that the average white T-shirt only provides a UPF rating of about 7, which is shocking because we should be aiming for 30 as a minimum. So Sunkin protective clothing is not only UV protective clothing, it achieves a UPF 50 plus rating, and we're endorsed by the Cancer Association of South Africa. And it's also natural fibers. And that's, you know, the really interesting bit, actually.
Please tell us about the process then of research and development for this interesting apparel, because a lot of clothing makers are helping to, you know, churn some T-shirts off and put branding on them. But this one is specific to make sure that it's protective, especially for young children.
No, that's absolutely, because I think beginning sun-safe habits from a young age is really crucial to take through into life. So I have a retail background, so I'm quite familiar with product development and sourcing. But I was on a mission to find a way of creating sun protective clothing using natural fibers. And there are a few companies, a few sportswear companies that do make this outdoor apparel, but they use, synthetic fibers like polyester, which isn't great for young kids in hot weather to wear. It's not particularly comfortable. So it's a lot of rabbit holes, a lot of speaking to experts both here and in the US. And I found the perfect combination of cotton that has the right weight, the right weave, and the color also makes a huge difference. And it's been tested, and yeah, they pass UPF 50 plus and they're certified.
Sourcing becomes an issue, especially when we talk about how much it would cost to make at least one T-shirt from your products. Have you been able to make to balance that out to make sure even to the end consumer it would be quite affordable?
Well, that's quite hard because we are at the early stages and we're not mass producing. I've come from different backgrounds. I have done the mass production side of things, but this is actually a much smaller process, and you know, it is going to grow. There has been a lot of interest, and we're doing very well for a new business that's only been up and running for less than 6 months. So a basic t-shirt comes in at 399 rand, which is expensive compared to what you can buy on the high street, but knowing that what's on the high street is not going to protect your child from the sun's harsh rays, I believe that the product justifies that price tag. As we get bigger, then yes, we can produce more, and we can, because at the moment we're using very small CMTs to support the local industry. And as we grow our production grows, then hopefully we can get a better price and pass that on to the customer.
Sunkin has also partnered with the Cancer Association of South Africa. How has that helped in making sure that you develop a product that's, of course, suitable but also cleared by authorities?
Well, it's given us immense credibility and the confidence to know that we're on the right track and we're able to promote a new concept such as this. It also allows us to deliver the message around sun safety in our daily lives, which is really, really important. And we can reach a wider audience than we possibly could have done on our own. So having their support is really critical. And I think we'll see that partnership grow in the future.
Are you targeting children with sensitive skin or any child to don some of your products?
It's all children. I mean, if you have darker skin, you can stay in the sun for longer. And then if you have paler skin and lighter eyes, you've got to limit the amount of time in the sun. But skin cancer doesn't choose. You know, it doesn't matter what color you are, where you come from, how old you are. It's prevalent, and you can get it at any age.
Was there a personal story that drove you to go this way in terms of products? Because I know you do have ointments that you already sell as the company, but why this clothing direction did you feel?
So I'm from the UK, as you may have guessed, and when I moved here, I noticed the wrinkles on my hands, on my face, like quite quickly, I would say within at least 1 year, and there was significant change to my skin. So, the seed was planted, it was back there. And it's only when I was applying sunscreen to my son that I started wondering about the sun protection in his regular clothing. And that's when I came across that fact about the UPF rating of the average T-shirt being 7. That's not sufficient. And we're living in a time of climate change and where the ozone layer is getting thinner, more UV rays are passing through. And this is going to become a bigger issue, you know, later on.
Apart from the commercial benefits of this, what do you hope this product to achieve, especially in South Africa as temperatures get higher?
Well, South Africa is number 3 in terms of the highest rates of skin cancer after Australia and New Zealand. So we need to have better awareness and better messaging from school age and for school age children to develop sun-safe habits from a very young age. I think that is the wider-reaching message that we really want to convey. Start young, teach your children to cover up, stay in the shade wherever possible, you know, put their wide-brim hats on and sunglasses as much as possible. And that is the main messaging, really.
There'll be those customers who want to know where the clothes are made, especially those that are very conscious and are into ethical processes when it comes to some of the products that they do consume. How does your process work? Where are the T-shirts made? And do you fly them into South Africa or are they produced here locally?
No, they're all produced locally. We work with small factories here in Cape Town. The cottons also, the knit fabrics are also sourced from local mills. So it's all very South African. It's produced here. The conception was here. It's a South African product, 100%.
You say the product is still in its infancy. Are you still at T-shirt stage or is a whole range of clothing like shorts, things like hats that have been produced as well that the parents can buy for their children?
Yes, it's all available on sunkinlife.com and the local edit. And we have a range of, it's a capsule collection at the moment and our theme is tigers. It's very cute and it's fashionable. It's T-shirts, shorts, dungarees, wide brim hats, all in line with cancer regulation. And there's little shorteries and it's all available to buy now. We're introducing some joggers and long sleeve tops as well as we get into winter because UV rays still 90% penetrate through cloud cover. So it's something to be aware of.
Love the innovation. Dee Kutsia, a founder of Sunkin, SunSafe Children's Clothing.
The Money Show
with Motheo Kgaripe
on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. About 7 minutes past seven now, getting into the sword fight between the chief marketing officer and the chief financial officer, a dynamic partnership for marketing effectiveness. We're talking to Kentsani Nopanda, the Nedbank's group's executive of marketing and corporate affairs. Now, marketing and finance in the past has been quite a combative tug of war between the two departments, with marketing spending money while finance is trying to manage the costs. Now, fortunately, this relationship is evolving more and more in the modern working world, becoming a symbiotic relationship where both parties can work together to achieve a common goal. Joined now by Kentsani. Kentsani, welcome to The Money Show. Kentsani, of course, Nopanda, Nedbank Group Executive of Marketing and Corporate Affairs. Looking at the two departments, one would venture to say marketing is more creative than it is finance, while finance is more money than it is creative. So how do the two stop clashing swords, if one can say it like that, and work together?
Yeah, so to be honest, it's been an incredibly interesting journey, right? Because as you rightly say, a lot of CFOs look at the marketing spend as a cost center, right? And, you know, if the business is in trouble, the first thing that they want to do is cut marketing budget. And I think the role of the CMO is to help both the CFO and the finance community understand what the value that marketing is. You can't just expect it to happen. You actually have to lean in and ensure that you are able to communicate a story around growing the consumer business, growing the business overall, and growing the brand. So both the short-term and long-term objectives. And if you can do that, you can absolutely form a formidable power couple between you and the CFO if you're a CMO. But some people wouldn't think that that's necessarily something that can happen. But I can tell you from my experience at Nedbank, it's absolutely something that can happen. And I mean, you know, I'm happy to chat through, especially in my case at Nedbank, with our CFO Mike Davis, how we've been able to achieve that.
Then looking at the one side of marketing where you would have strategy documents, you'd have marketing decks put together for the bank in your case. And on the other end, it would be a lot of graphs and numbers. How do you marry the two to make sure that one that's sitting at the East Wing can meet the other department at the West Wing?
I think the first thing is, as a marketing team, you have to have a business plan. That's not about pretty pictures, right? Everyone who thinks about marketing, they think advertising and all the nice things. But actually, you have to build a business plan that says, what are the consumer opportunities? What are the business opportunities and issues that marketing can deliver to? And when you build your business plan, you have to build the business plan talking about how marketing can add value to the opportunities and the issues that the business has. And what advertising actually in the end does is answer to those issues and to those opportunities versus just standing there as a marketer and saying, hi, we're going to have a great brand campaign and it's going to be beautiful advertising and everything. Your advertising and everything have to speak to what the business agenda is. So even when you present your business plan, as a marketer, you can't stand there in front of the board or in front of the exco and just talk about, we're going to have great ads and pretty pictures. You really have to articulate just how marketing can add to the bottom line. And we're very lucky, by the way, as marketers these days, because as the world has gone more digital, we've seen our marketing spend become much more digital. What does that mean? It means that the way we can prove our return on marketing investment is actually much more obvious now, because we can show the CFO, we can show the board, we can show the exco team that in order for you to grow market share, for example, let's say in home loans, you need people to come into the marketing funnel, because you can only come into the marketing funnel through marketing. And then how do we then convert the leads that come into the marketing funnel to end up converting those leads into actual business. And once you can showcase that, you are actually in a very different space. I mean, for example, when I presented the Nedbank marketing business plan last year, funnily enough, I didn't show any ads. What I showed was, here are the issues that are in, that stand in front of Nedbank in terms of our market share growth aspirations, our business issues. Some people don't think we're as digital as we are. And when you build that case and then say, here's how marketing is going to answer to that, all of a sudden you're having a value creation conversation versus a cost center conversation. So for me, that's important, because what marketing has to show is it has to show that we are a value creator and not a cost center.
So are you saying the modern marketer then has to speak the right language to, you know, transcend to the bean counter of the company, if you want to call it that, and the chief financial officer, to make sure that when you even present the numbers to them in terms of budget, they can agree that there is set value that comes with your operation?
Absolutely. And you have to teach each other. So Mike Davis and I, who's the CFO at Nedbank, we actually have a monthly meeting, which is not normal. I've never done it in any other business I've worked with. And in that monthly meeting, firstly, what we do is we teach each other what's important in marketing to be able to drive business growth. He also helps me understand what are the priorities that will help drive, you know, the business growth. And then we work through these two things together. By the time we get to speak to Exco and the board, it's actually funny because we are now supporting each other, whereas normally you will have a CFO who will be like, yeah, but I don't know the value that you're adding. But this time, because you guys have built this strong relationship, he actually becomes one of your biggest supporters in that conversation. I'll give an example. During COVID, as you know, most of the banks, you know, our headline earnings were exceedingly down based on, you know, impairments and all of that. And in most businesses that I'd worked in, if your headline earnings are going to be about 60% down, your CFO says to you, you must cut your marketing budget by 60% or even more. The way Mike Davis did it, because we've now built this like power couple relationship, and I had proven to Exco, by the way, that during the financial crisis, brands that didn't say anything in the market when they came out of the financial crisis actually came out worse off. But brands that continued to communicate during the financial crisis came out of they came out of that period as much stronger brands. So during COVID, Mike Davis didn't come to me and say, listen here, our headline earnings are going to be about 58% down, so you must cut your budget down by that much. He said to me, you understand the business. You know what's required. What do you think? Obviously, I have to cut some marketing budget, right? Because the business, you know, it's not doing as well given the environment. What do you think is the right amount of marketing spend to continue to have in the market to be able that when we come out of COVID, we come out stronger? So actually, our marketing budget ended up coming down 20% versus a headline earnings of 60% down. To get a relationship like that where you're not told as a marketer, decrease your budget, here's what it is, you actually have to tell the story about why it's important that you continue to build your brand in a period like that. And it helped us as Nedbank because when we came out of that period, actually, we were recognized as the best brand that in how we treated our clients, in how we communicated with our clients. And then if you looked at our brand matrix, when we came out of that, we were really, really strong because we continued to communicate. And when your CFO understands that because it's a value creator, because I believe that, I mean, if you think about selling anything, a home loan is a home loan, right? Or maybe the difference is your interest rate and how long you take it for. So you must decide where you're going to get that home loan.
Yeah.
But if you continue to communicate in that period, your brand is actually top of mind. So when people start coming into an economy that starts to grow after declining, you're the first brand that they look at because during that period, you had communication in the market. You spoke about some of the challenges in terms of how to manage your money during a period like that. And then we came out like looking stronger than we were actually coming into COVID and stuff.
And Kentani, then what would the marketing department, the finance department learn from marketing then? Because you've told us on your side what you've learned from them in terms of making sure you can communicate the ROI that comes with marketing. But on the on the finance side, what are they learning from the brand creation that you are creating for the bank?
They have to understand that they are almost, I'm going to simplify it to say there's two roles to marketing, right? Simplified. There is short term, you want to win, grow market share, get people to get bank accounts, get people to deposit with us. That's the short term. But that's if someone builds a stronger brand, if you do that without building a long-term strong brand, that's actually too short term. You're not building a long-term strong brand. So what the finance community has to learn is that you have to do both. I always say it's and. The finance community can learn that, yes, these guys are going to give us short-term gains in terms of some of our business challenges. But at the same time, they are building a long-term brand that actually makes using our budget a lot better in the long term, right? Because we've been able to build the brand in the long term versus just focusing on the short term.
All right, that's the relationship between the chief marketing officer and the chief financial officer these days, sitting much closer to each other and sharing lessons for the betterment of the company. Kentani Nopanda, Nedbank's Group Executive of Marketing and Corporate Affairs.
702 and K Talk. Motheo is on The Money Show.
Looking at the small business focus now at 18 minutes past 7, talking business coaching and how it differs from mentorship and consulting, joined by Anton Ressel now for this conversation, strategic head for SME support at Fedola. Anton, welcome again to The Money Show. A lot of people can confuse these mentorship, consulting and business coaching, but what is key about business coaching that's so different from mentorship?
Hey, Matea, evening. Nice to be back with you again. I think it essentially boils down to what you need. You know, they're all three, consulting, mentoring, and coaching, are designed to support individuals and enterprises to help them progress, move forward, solve problems. But it really depends on what your needs are in terms of which is the best fit for you. And there's a lot of confusion and sort of gray areas, particularly between mentoring and coaching, where people tend to almost think that they're the same thing, but in reality they're actually quite different. And if I could sum it up in a concise fashion, consulting is more hands-on. It's usually quite short term. It would be when someone actually comes into your business and does a piece of work. For example, they set up your IT system, or they help you implement a financial management system. So it's very hands-on, and the consultant actually does the work. Mentoring is more where someone who's usually quite experienced in business, they've walked a journey, and they're essentially there to help share that experience and guide you along your journey as an entrepreneur. Whereas coaching is more about personal development, looking at certain blockages that you might have, certain sort of skills that you need to develop, focusing on setting goals. So it's quite action-based, and it's normally quite a long-term relationship where the other two can be short-term. So I think that sort of sums it up in a nutshell.
So as a business owner, given that you've started this business, you want to scale, there's things you need to change in your systems. How do you decide what you need for your business? Because as you've said, a consultant will give you maybe better systems and look how you can improve in terms of operations. What does a business coach give you going forward to make sure your business is sustainable?
So I think a coach, I mean, it usually depends on the kind of stage of your business journey as to which is the right fit for you, and sometimes you might need a range of different support. A coach would be someone that I do a lot of coaching, and my clients are typically people who are relatively successful. They've got an established business, they perhaps poised for growth, and they need a bit of support in terms of focus, in terms of juggling multiple balls. Busy founders, maybe they've got a growing family, they've got responsibilities, and it's how does one sort of stay focused on end goals? How do you decide what's important? How do you prioritize? That would be the kind of conversations we'd have from a coaching perspective. You know, I'd ask certain quite probing questions. And coaching is very much about self-reflection. A good coach, in my opinion anyway, doesn't tell you what to do. They guide you towards the answers that are already within you, but perhaps just need a little bit of help to be uncovered. Whereas a mentor is a little bit more pragmatic and practical. They'll give you actual advice from their experience. They'll often help introduce you to networks. And then finally, a consultant would be someone who literally comes in to do a specific piece of work. So it's usually quite short term. It's project based. It's not necessarily involving any kind of personal development. It's more purely about giving the business some tools and some resources that it needs.
So what I'm getting from you then is that a business coach is not somebody that's going to entirely hold your hand, but they will give you guidance in terms of how to restructure your life to so you can be better for your business as the person running it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you don't mind, can I ask you a coaching question?
Sure.
Let's demonstrate for the listeners in real terms. So if I just say to you, Matteo, if fear didn't exist for you, who would you become and what would you really want in life?
Yo, I'd be the best I can be. Of course, with fear not in my way, I would go for far riskier decisions in my business.
Okay, so there's an example of a coaching question. You know, it's another one might be something like, what has to happen for you to change, Matteo, for you to grasp that opportunity with both hands, to really decide to sort of 10x your business? What has to change?
I think trusting my staff more, making sure that I can let them do the job instead of micromanaging the business, which takes up most of my time. I often need to take more time away to think more about the business going forward instead of being hands-on on a daily basis.
Okay, so I just coached you in 2 minutes. That was brilliant, by the way. Awesome response. And that's exactly the kind of thing that a coach, kind of questions and conversations that a coach would ask. You know, it's really about introspection. It's about you knowing the answers, but just needing a bit of help to really, I suppose, prioritize and focus on the right ones. A mentor, on the other hand, would be more about your strategy. You know, are you engaging with the right target markets? You know, in their experience, this is what they've learned when they, you know, try certain things. So that it's a little bit more, I suppose, focused on the business and the business model and not so much on the individual.
So if I could call it business therapy, then coaching would look at the things that would better me as a person leading the company. But is it a popular form of consulting, if you will, coaching in the business world? Because a lot of business owners don't like to be told what to do or to be probed on how they're going to better their businesses. They think they're doing just fine.
Yeah, that is true. Look, I suppose guys like me wouldn't have a career if it weren't in demand in some regard. I think that people normally have to bang their heads a bit before they reach out for coaching. So whereas mentorship is something that's quite accessible and fairly non-invasive, coaching is a journey. It's a process, and it's a process of self-discovery. I had a coach for many years who really helped me look at my strategy and myself and certain limiting beliefs that I held. And I think that coaching is right for you if you feel like there's more for you to achieve and that you know in your heart that there's certain patterns that you are exhibiting and that you sort of repeat that are holding you back. then I would recommend that you do reach out to a coach. And, you know, there is life coaching, which has got a little bit of a bad name in some circles. Maybe not bad, but, you know, every second person and his dog doesn't have the best a life PR. Coach. Whereas business coaching, it is you kind of hit the nail on the head earlier when you said that it's very much like therapy for business owners. That is a lot of what I do. You know, it's really we have conversations, we unpack stuff, and we identify things that are potentially preventing you from achieving your goals and being the best version of yourself.
And as a business coach, at what point are you willing to come into the business to help the business owner? Is it after the first day they start the business, or you want them to build something first and then come in as the coach?
Well, sometimes, interesting question, because sometimes my work involves working with people who have an idea, but they're paralyzed. They don't know where to go. They might be very innovative. They might be visionary even, but taking that first step is scary, or there's a fear of failure, or there's risk aversion, or there's perhaps overconfidence that that causes them to constantly, you know, reach dead ends. So it's not necessarily about where they're at in the stage of business. I think it's more about acknowledging that there's more that you could be achieving that you aren't, and maybe with someone to bounce things off and someone to probe and ask the right questions, you could actually achieve a hell of a lot more.
Then looking at the business as a business coach, do you want to come in and when do you let go of a business that you're helping? I mean, you can start a process with them, but at what point do you say, look, you're well coached now, I think you can take this business forward?
Yeah, and that's also a good question. You know, I do sometimes end up many years down the line still engaging with clients. And I know that at Fotola, we also have that where people graduate from our programs and 4, 5, 6, 10 years down the line are still keen to stay in touch and reach out and get advice. And I guess it's really up to the individual in essence, but coaching can be a very long-term relationship. It's like a therapist, I guess. You know, you go to therapy as long as you feel like you need it. And it would probably be the same with coaching. When you're feeling strong and confident, it's not to say that you don't need coaching at those times, because there's always more to achieve, but it's usually most appropriate when you are feeling stuck. And that's when you'd want to reach out and get someone to help you.
And it sounds to me, before I let you go, Anton, that it's highly committal, because a business owner can call you at any point for you to be a sounding board. So how do you manage the times of when you get coached?
I put my phone on silent. Yeah, that's a good one as well. I like to try personally, and all coaches work in a different way, but I like to try and be quite structured, not necessarily in terms of our sessions and our conversations, but in terms of when we meet. So with my regular clients, I will meet usually either once a week or once every 2 weeks, sometimes even once a month, but it's fairly consistent. It's in the diary. And if they do have any crisis or they're needing a bit of support in between, you know, I am always available. And I think any good coach would be, because it is a commitment, like you said, it's a relationship.
All right, that was Anton Ressel, strategic head for SME support at
The Money Show
Investment School.
And in our investment school today, we have our head teacher as Viv Govender, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, talking about why we fall for dodgy investment and how to avoid these dodgy investments. Look, you can't make these things up. On Eyewitness News, as you've just heard, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority has issued a public warning against a Berry investing scheme promising unrealistic returns of up to 45.1% a month. The regulator warned against doing any business with Indie Berries & Co., whose website describes it as a platform that facilitates investment into the ventures of more than 300 evaluated and approved berry farmers across 7 countries. Indie Berries & Co. Facebook page describes it as an investment management company and claims to have around 300,000 active investors. From what I've just read to you, Viv, what are the red flags that you're picking up there already?
Well, the number one red flag is the return level. I mean, we're talking about double digit, like what's it, 40% returns per month. If you just basically worked out that, you know, say a year or two to the future and say, what would happen if I made 140-70% return every month? At that rate, you'd be doubling your money in less than 2 months. In 6 months of the year, you'd basically go from, six doublings, therefore, in a year, or seven doublings in a year. So you'd be getting basically, for the first, say, 10 rand you put in, you'd have 20 rand by the second 2 months, you'd have 40, 80, you know, it goes up dramatically. And by the time you're into like 5 years of the future, you're the richest person on earth. And the question you've got to ask yourself is this: why doesn't a bank lend these people money if they are willing to pay such a massive return and they are so safe? Banks lend money to everybody all the time. The reason that they don't lend money to some people and not others is because they don't trust them to pay it back. But if they think somebody's like a really bad risk, they ask them a higher interest rate. No bank is charging 41% a month. And so you can just understand that no bank would possibly, you know, be, you know, offering these people money, because if they did, 41% a month, they would be getting a much lower rate elsewhere. So they wouldn't need to pay you this money to basically invest. And they could get this funding from other places. So the smartest institution, are the banks, the financial investors in the world, are not willing to lend these guys money. And why should you?
Too good to be true, Viv, but we seem to always fall for this somehow. You know, great returns, put in 1,000 rand, in the next 30 days you'll get 2,500 rand. We seem to want the quick cash. What is it about human behavior that gets us into so much trouble?
You know, you speak about, you know, coincidence, and one of the weird coincidences is that the person that basically described, you know, these flaws in human behavior, a guy called Daniel Kahneman, just passed away, you know, just recently. And he was actually, he and his colleague, Amos Tversky, I believe his name was, developed these ideas about imbalances in human, reasoning effectively. And this is something that is true. That's why we have things like casinos. That's why we have things like the lotto, because people make these consistent errors when it comes to, making these kind of decisions. They consistently make, you know, predictable errors when it comes to evaluating risk, evaluating returns, and, you know, especially when it comes to numbers. And I think that's one of the reasons that people often fall for this. It's like some people say the lotto is a tax on the stupid. To some extent, you know, these kind of schemes are almost a crime against the naive. And in fact, you know, a thing I've found, generally, is that when you look at some of the prospectus of these particular schemes, they often do things like, you know, have misspellings in them, or, you know, bad grammar sometimes. The reason being is that they kind of want to filter out people that are able to spot these kind of things and effectively only attack the weaker prey when it comes to these scams.
So this would be the natural selection then of those that are being duped in terms of dodgy investments. Then looking at, you know, the type of greed that we have and also the impulse decisions we make. Could somebody that walks into a store planning to buy just bread and walks out with a whole lot of products in their basket be susceptible to such, schemes? Or is it also people who are professional, people who would be, looking for investments? They've been in investments for a long time that also fall for these kind of schemes.
Look, I mean, it's quite a number of people. Often what often translates into an issue is the fact that people often don't have the right training in like financial matters. So you'll find somebody that's, for instance, a well-trained professional in, for instance, the medical field or in engineering, you know, a smart person, well-trained, an expert in their particular field. And when they basically see somebody else out there, they think that I know what I'm doing in this particular field, and they can translate that confidence and expertise over to another field. And that's often an issue where, you know, we do see, people get, you know, to a certain extent taken for a ride, one might say. The second thing is that these guys often operate with kind of like a vetting system. So what they do is they break into a social group, a social network. I mean, a famous case like this was, everyone knows about Bernie Madoff, right? He targeted the Jewish community, in particularly the U.S. And so what would happen is people would say, oh, but it sounds too good to be true. But my friend who I know, and he's a smart person, is in this particular thing. So it probably is not, you know, an issue. And that's often also what happens is once one person in the group gets, you know, to some extent taken in, other people can often be taken in because they know their friend, and they know the friend is not stupid. They know the friend is trustworthy. If the friend's in this particular deal, they would go along with it as well. So there's a number of ways in which, like, otherwise very smart, very well-educated people do to some extent get caught up in these particular schemes.
So conversations around the dinner table, maybe a boss that you trust at work could also get you into some trouble. But looking at, you know, taking the time to do the proper research on the investments that we do take out, how important is that? Because the opportunity is often, you know, given as something that has a small window and you have to do it quickly. But how do we make sure that we safeguard ourselves by going through all these promises that are on these particular websites and checking them out with perhaps somebody who has far better knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, the example I'd give you is imagine if you had to go to the pharmacy and you had some kind of illness and you wanted to take something there, but you would have to go through yourself and look at each drug and figure out what each one does and whether or not it's suitable for you or not. That is not something reasonable to expect from the normal person to do. You can, and there's nothing about medical science that a smart person with, you know, a lot of time and, you know, energy could actually not decipher. But you would expect to go to a professional, a trusted professional, somebody think, oh, this doctor is my doctor. I know what he's reasonable. He knows what he's doing. And then ask him questions around the particular thing you want to try out. And the same thing applies to the financial sector as well. If you aren't willing to take the time and don't have the energy and et cetera to basically evaluate these things yourself, you know, it's good to have somebody you can talk to and say, you know, what do you think about this particular thing? And if you do, you know, sometimes you have time. Everybody needs a second opinion once in a while. And if you have a particular investment you want to get into and you don't, are not certain about it, you know, speaking to a trusted, person who's knowledgeable in the field could be very useful, at least in getting a second opinion. And maybe they could point out things that you may have missed in terms of red flags.
And what sort of questions should we be asking for those red flags? I mean, things that you can go through that a normal investment company would be able, should be able to answer.
Well, the first thing is, you know, in South Africa, you want the FSP number. You want to have a company that's registered by the FSCA because there is a minimum level of guarantee that these guys are to such a legitimate. Of course, not to say that every FSCA company is a rich company or every FSP is totally legit. But there's been obviously cases in the past where companies that have FSP numbers, you know, are not legit. But they are the minority. And, you know, definitely I far, you know, with no other information, prefer a company that has FSP number registered, you know, the people that are, you know, is properly licensed to do the particular kind of investment that you want to do with the company. So that's the number one thing. Number two, I would say basically, you know, just a common sense looking at whether or not these particular individuals are offering a return that kind of makes sense. Like I said, you know, someone returning 40% a month, you know, doesn't make sense because you'd be basically getting to a point where, you know, a couple thousand rands would make you a millionaire in a year's or a couple of years' time and a billionaire in a couple of years afterwards. And a couple of years after that, you'll be richer than Elon Musk. No investment should be making you richer than Elon Musk on a guaranteed basis for a 1,000 rand investment in less than 5 years. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense. So those kind of things, you know, don't look at the like initial things. If this is true, and imagine it rolled out for a few more months, what is the kind of return I'd be expected to get? Not reinvest my initial investment, but roll the whole thing over and over and over again. And another key aspect here is that do they charge you or are there limits with withdrawing your money? This is one of those absolute schemes that are absolute you know, red flags. Wherever somebody has an issue giving you back your money, that is something where I would never want to be invested in. I had a client a while back who got involved in the scheme, and it was a multinational one with operations in Australia and China, I believe, in a couple other places. And he called me up and asked me, basically, these guys have my money. Now they say to return my initial investment, I must pay them more money.
Yeah,
didn't you see that's an absolute
deal with the mafia. Yeah,
yeah. Why would they? If you have your money, why would you have to give them more money to get the original money back? You know, I mean, why don't they just deduct from your winnings, effectively? They say, oh, I've made 10 times my initial investment. Yeah, but you have to put in another, like, you know, you put in a certain amount of money. It's not 10 times more. It's worth 1 million rands, but you can put in another 100,000 to get that 1 million rands back. Why would that be? Why don't you just deduct it from the 1 million rands you have with me already? Those kind of things really don't make sense. Look at what now, people are domiciled. Look at, yeah.
Yeah, there's a very big elephant here in the 702 studio, and that would be greed for me, because you find that a lot of these schemes will target people that are getting lump sums like pensions and retirement annuities, and you've got all this money, you've saved up all these years, you've taken the time to save up during your career, you come to retirement, you get a lump sum, and all of a sudden you want, you know, double-digit returns on the money you've saved for so long. Why do we get that urge when we already are cash flush?
Look, I mean, people are greedy. That's just the fact of life. And often it's not the really cash flush people that... The one thing I found with really wealthy people is they don't really want to risk their money. They're more concerned with preserving what they have. It's often people that are, you know, a bit tighter in the money that are looking for almost a Hail Mary pass that gets them out of, you know, danger. You know what I mean? You don't find the truly wealthy people getting involved. This is usually people that don't have enough, quite frankly. And so that's one thing to be looked at. The next thing to look at, of course, is the fact that people are often overconfident. You know, they, like I said, they're overconfident about their ability to spot something. And, you know, that's another issue. And finally, like I said, these guys are smart. They know what they're doing. And, you know, you can't, if somebody came to you and basically beat you up and stole your money, you would not say to me, Viv, I was weak and therefore I deserve to be, you know, robbed. You wouldn't say that to me, would you? You'd say the guy was stronger than me and therefore that. Why do we say when somebody is able to manipulate you with their mind as opposed to with their body that you are not the victim? You know what I mean? Just if someone is skilled in basically, you know, manipulation, someone is like maybe was experienced and knowledgeable about certain things, they could quite easily, you know, take advantage of you just as someone that's physically stronger or learned martial art could beat you up physically. And we mustn't always, you know, just say that the person that's taken advantage of was, you know, greedy or, you know, not a victim in that sense. Yeah.
Like, look, Viv, these liars are really, really good. In conversation with Viv Govender, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, our head teacher today in our investment school, talking why we fall for dodgy investments and how to avoid them. Join us for more on this conversation after this.
The Money Show.
Investment School.
Chatting to Viv Govender, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, talking to us about why we fall for dodgy investments and how we can avoid them. Now, Viv, some of these dodgy investments are quite good. You know, you might know a friend who's telling you about all these returns. He's showing you his own account. He's gotten his money back a few times. How do you then discern whether this is true or not, or still a risky investment for you when your own pal or someone that you trust tells you that they've gotten the returns and you've seen the lifestyle change?
Look, I mean, these things do occur. I mean, like I said, the Bernie Madoff scheme ran for many, many years. It was founded by, like I said, Bernie Madoff. Bernie Madoff was not some scamster. Bernie Madoff basically helped found the NASDAQ. You know what I mean? He was a seriously, you know, influential financial individual, and yet it was a scam. In that particular thing, the only way you would have spotted it is to basically look at the return profile and see that it was not realistic and, you know, it wasn't correct. But everything else about him, the fact that he was well known, the fact that he returned money, that's one of the features of a Ponzi scheme. The way a Ponzi scheme works is that you pay in money and you do get money initially. The problem is as more and more people basically get into the scheme, more and more money needs to be paid out. And the only way to pay out that money is to get more people in. And eventually you run out of people. That's how a pyramid scheme works. It starts with a small top and a wider and wider base. And eventually that base collapses and the whole thing collapses. So these kind of schemes often do have that trait where you will have a friend getting into something. They will make money and they will basically show you that money initially. The problem is that, you know, the next person after that in the rung often is getting closer and closer to the risk of that scheme losing money, number one. Number two, there are actual legitimate things out there called multi-level marketing where there is that kind of similar pyramid structure. But, you know, there is an underlying product that's worth, you know, buying. And that scenario that you might find, you know, it's similar to some of these Ponzi schemes. The way I would usually, like, you know, phrase it in this way is that look at the actual business, look at what they actually are offering and see if it kind of makes common sense to you. Regarding this example with the berry farms, the 14% return per month just does not make sense. With Bernie Madoff, it was, I think, 8 or 9% per year guaranteed almost. And that doesn't make sense. You can't get that kind of return guaranteed. There wasn't the trade going to the market, but you did quite a bit more information to know that it's happening. So a lot of these things are very hard to spot, other than to say, this does just not make sense to me. And that's the only, I think, the golden rule you should follow.
We've had examples like, I think it was Triple M, Fidentia was another a big Ponzi scheme, the SA Ponzi.co.za scam that even took and, you know, pulled the wool over those that we consider financial professionals as well. So, you know, getting into the research part of it, you know, if I hear about a great investment opportunity, should I also be calling up my broker to say, before I put money into this, can you have a good look at it and give me your assessment?
Yes, I think having a person that, like, you would have a medical professional in your life that you can ask if there's a problem. You should have a financial professional in your life that you can ask if there's an issue. You know, somebody that can look at things and give you, you know, a heads up as to what looks reasonable or not. The second thing is that, I mean, like I said, make sure, number one, that if someone's going to take your money, that they are registered with the FSCA or with some regulatory body if it's an international company. Don't just go to any company that says they're going to take your money and give you a return without seeing if they're registered with some reputable agency. And finally, like I said, it's the smell test. You've got to see if it makes sense to you. And even sometimes, you know, there are schemes out there that turn out in the end to be incredibly profitable, like crypto. I mean, crypto never passed my particular smell test, and that's why I never invested in it. But, you know, obviously, if you had, there'd be a fortune to have been made in the past, you know what I mean?
Yeah, because there's those things that come up in the markets like cryptocurrencies and all sorts of, you know, investment in chips of late, AI, all sorts of things that could be put on social media as great returns. But, you know, the 1920s fraudster Charles Ponzi, a very long time ago, these things keep happening. How do I walk out with my money, even if I've gotten myself into some of these things? I mean, you often hear that when you hear about a Ponzi scheme, it's probably too late.
Yeah, look, I mean, if you think you're in a scheme, get your money out immediately. Just be as quick as possible about it. But be aware that if it is an actual Ponzi scheme, often any of the gains you have, you know, taken out over time can be claimed back. That was the case with Bernie Madoff, where a number of people basically were taking out returns over many, many years from this particular scheme, thinking it was a proper investment. Imagine you put money in the bank and for like 20 years and you get like 5%, 8% a year. And then suddenly after 20 years, somebody comes to you and says, hey, you know that interest you collected for the last 20 years, that's actually ill-gotten gains with somebody else's money. Please give us back. That is what happened there. So just be aware of that. But if you do think you are in a scheme, get your money out. That's the best thing to do. Get it out as quickly as you possibly can. Hopefully the scheme isn't collapsing yet. And so they might want to keep quiet and give you your money out early, just to, like, you know, stop the bother. But as soon as you think you are in a scheme, get your money out and try and get the money out as quickly as possible. And don't take any delays for an answer.
And as we wrap, Viv, just a short answer around playing the long game, rather, because a lot of people just want quick returns.
Yeah, look, I mean, here's the thing. If you are, you know, just a normal working person and make a good amount of money in their lives, you know, a reasonable amount of money, and you just put your money straight into the stock market, don't even go, like, look at particular stocks, just buy the overall index, you should do fine. You know, you're not going to be a multi-millionaire, but you're not also going to be losing the majority of your money. That is the number one thing. The things that are offering you more than this, offering you significantly above what the market return is, those things are usually coming out either with real risk or on a scam. And unless you are an extremely, you know, confident financial professional, I would suggest that you avoid them if at all possible.
Well, don't be duped. That was Viv Govender, portfolio manager at Rand Swiss, our head teacher today in our investment school, talking about why we fall for dodgy investments and how to avoid them. Thank you so much for that conversation.